Well, we want to chat about you and about Brothers. I think one of the first things I'd like to ask you is about some of your research into Brothers, because I know that you had gone to the Soviet Union to do some research, and you apparently had some problems with the Soviet authorities. You wanted to talk to Jewish citizens of the Soviet Union, and tell me about that experience.
Well, I have, as a preamble to that, my way of doing research is to write it first and then go and see if I got it right. And in fact, I knew a lot in theory about the situation of Jews in the Soviet Union today, mainly because I work in the movement for dissidents and refuseniks, and because I'd already read the Amnesty reports, which are very dull reading, but very reliable. So I knew all the facts of it. And in fact, I had written most of the fourth part of the book, which deals with the Soviet Union. I had a chance to go there, and with a friend of mine, and they clearly didn't realize who either of us were, because we were both very strong in the movement, until we arrived. By the time we got there, of course, they realized who we were, and they followed us, the usual business. And we were told not to go into people's houses. So we had to meet everyone. We wanted to see the refuseniks we had contact with and who very much wanted to meet, to have contact with someone in the West, because they have nothing to lose now. We met them in all kinds of parks and squares. So I know Moscow parks and squares very well indeed.
Excuse me, did the authorities just go to you and say, do not visit that house, do not visit that person? Or did they make this a blanket?
No, they wouldn't say that, because there is no law in the Soviet Union to say you can't see people, you can't go into people's houses. But they suggested it wouldn't be in our interest if we were to meet these people. They're very careful about saying whether there's a law for it or not. We spent 3 days in Moscow, saw a number of people, and we were on our way to Leningrad when they picked us up and deported us on the grounds that we were against peace. Well, that's a pretty ambivalent statement, and you can't in a way refute it. According to their peace standards, of course we're against peace.
What happened at the airport?
Unpleasant, because I refused to go without a letter from them stating why we were being sent away, which clearly they weren't going to give. They made all kinds of promises that by the time the plane arrived, the letter would come through. Meanwhile, they shoved us into part of the departure lounge, which was not occupied, because if there's going to be any rough stuff, they don't want the public to see. And they kept us there the whole day under guard, nothing to eat. I wasn't frightened, actually, until the dogs came. One big Alsatian dog. I don't like dogs very much. And the passengers who were going home from the Soviet Union to England, it was an English plane, I had to pass through our part of the departure lounge. So we composed a little note that we thought we'd look for a sympathetic passenger and ask him to give this note to our husbands in London, to say that we were all right, and to get in touch with the British Embassy, because we weren't allowed even to get in touch with the embassy. Having done that with one of the passengers, I felt a little bit more secure. And we refused to go. They came up to us and they said, here are your passports, get on the plane. And we said no. We were being rather foolish, I think, when I look back on it, because they could have just put us away. And eventually we would have gotten out, but it would have been very unpleasant. So in the end, they just carried us, two thugs between us. I mean, two thugs each, two middle-aged ladies. And they just carried us onto the plane. It was an unpleasant experience.
They did not invite you to come back.
Oh, not at all. But you see, 2 years earlier, I was in Lesotho in South Africa. You know, you can't get into Lesotho without going through Johannesburg. And I was writing an article for The Observer. And I was thrown out of South Africa, too, for my views. And it struck me, here am I, I've been thrown out of two diametrically opposed systems, and I'm the same person. So there must be some equalizer there, you know?
Tell me about this research. You say you'd like to do the research after you've done the writing to check it, but how is that possible? Here you, brothers starts in Tsarist Russia, many generations. How possibly would you have known all that information without doing some research in advance?
Well, I had by chance, only by chance, read the Alexander Herzen memoirs of the... I was just reading it for fun. Of Tsar Nicholas the first time in period in Russia, and came across this devastating sentence that when he came across people who protested against his regime, he put them in lunatic asylums. And the thought occurred to me that it hadn't changed. Nothing had changed in almost 200 years. That was the genesis of the novel, really. And for the research into that period, I did read Herzen. And he's a chronicler of the times, and he's very reliable. I also came to New York because you have a museum here, the YIVO Archive Museum. Do you know about it?
No, I don't.
It houses all the manuscripts of Jewish interest, of Jewish history from all over the world. It's a wonderful museum, absolutely priceless manuscripts there. But most of the stuff that pertained to this period was written in Yiddish, and I don't have Yiddish. But I knew enough about it. I was interested in the conscription of young children. And there were one or two, well, there were a few hundred survivors from this child conscription, and they had written diaries. And those diaries are in that archive. But since they were in Yiddish and Russian, I had really had little access. But I think if you're a writer and you know that you're in a situation of pain and peril, you ought to be able to write about it wherever the location or whatever the period of time.
Bernice Rubens, were there any parallels in brothers to your own family background?
Oh, yes. My father's grandfather is probably the patriarch of the story. He lived in Riga, but I put him in Odessa because it was a more exciting location for Jews at the time. My grandfather lived the kind of life in Wales that I depict in the second part of the book. He worked, he did business with the miners in the mining valleys. The third part of the book, which deals with the Holocaust, well, every Jew is related in some way to the Holocaust, I suppose. My husband was a child refugee from Germany and lost most of his family in Auschwitz. I don't have any direct relation to the fourth part of the book, which takes place in the Soviet Union, except insofar as I'm Jewish and Jews are related. Yes, of course it's autobiographical, yes.
You have kind of an interesting story about your father and how he happened to wind up in Cardiff, Wales.
I think that's a story that many Jews might tell. Jews who now live in Manchester, who went to, possibly landed at Hull or in Glasgow. All these were very busy ports at the time. And they got their tickets in Hamburg, where there were touts and dishonest men. And they said they wanted to go to America because America was paid with gold, and nothing would shake them in that belief. And they were put on a boat, and they just arrived. And they might have arrived in Cardiff, where my father arrived, or in Scotland, where many arrived, or in Hull, under the impression that they were in New York. It happened very often. I mean, it seems an incredible story, but my father actually believed for 3 weeks that he was in New York, and he was treading the ungold pavement of Cardiff.
He wouldn't have found it in New York either.
No, but it was a dream, wasn't it?
Your first book was called Set on Edge, and you wrote that when you were 30 years old. How did this book come about?
Set on Edge?
Mm-hmm.
It's about my family. I'd never written before, and I really sat down and wrote because I had nothing else to do. My children were in school, and I thought I'd try, and I wrote about my family, which is the easiest thing. It's safe ground, in a way, isn't it, to write about things you know. I found I enjoyed writing very much. I was very lucky with it, because I had no problems with publication, and it did well. And It was the second book that was hard to write, not the first.
Why is that?
The second book proves whether you've got the discipline to be a writer. I think that everybody can start a novel, not everyone can finish it. And that applies very much to the second book. The first book is easier in a way because you've nothing to lose and you have kind of audacity. And in many ways, if your first book is good, you'll never write better because you've got that chutzpah that you lose after a while. The second book is hard. If you can get over the second book, I think you're all right.
Yes, there are some publishers who will look sometimes, if the book is good, first novel, they might take a chance on that. But if it doesn't turn out as well as it might have, sometimes it's very difficult to get a second novel published, in this country at least.
I think the publishing scene is very different in both countries, actually. Different in the sense that it seems to me that the English publisher buys a writer, he doesn't buy a book. And in that sense, he's possibly more loyal. He will carry his writer, expecting him not to make money for a while, and expecting him even to write a bad book. But if he believes in him as a writer, he'll hold him. In America, I think publishers buy books rather than writers. By this token, I think they're better at publishing here than they are in England, because England, we're very respectable and not very commercially minded. You know, writing a book in England is, you still have in a way to apologize for it. It's rude. You know, we have such a wonderful and strong tradition of literature that it's still considered a kind of trespass if a contemporary novelist wants to go into the field of Dickens, Jane Austen, and George Eliot. So the whole attitude of publishing is very different here. A book becomes as negotiable as a packet of detergent, and that's how it's sold. And writers like this. Whatever writers may tell you otherwise, they do.
I think your perception is correct about American publishers buying books rather than writers, although there are a few publishing houses who do tend to, in effect, buy writers. And these include Knopf, Viking.
It includes Summit Press, with whom I did publish. But that, I think, depends on the person, the editor. I think that the publishing houses really take their cue from the main editor.
Mm-hmm. Bernice Rubens, you wrote about your family in your first book, Set on Edge. What was it like growing up in Cardiff, Wales?
I remember it with a lot of affection. And I think I would have been happier there than growing up in a big town. It was a very closed Jewish community and very safe. It was also very Welsh. And the Welsh people are not unlike Jews. They're very clannish, they're very warm, and they live in peril, which gives them, well, certainly in the valley where I live, which in that time and still is a mining valley, and where people's lives were shortened by things like silicosis. I mean, that was an everyday occurrence. So when I say they lived at risk, that was their lifestyle. The Jews had lived at risk, and being Jewish, they, I suppose, had a sense of historical risk. We were deeply welcomed in Wales, and Wales has a very admirable history of its welcoming of foreigners into its country.
What did your father do?
My father was a credit draper, as in the book. He sold, it was a profession that many immigrants took at the time because it didn't necessitate any financial investment. It didn't necessitate financial investment.
No, I missed. What was your father's employment?
It's called credit drapery. And what it means is that he bought suits, perhaps, or shoes and shirts, and he would take them to the mining valleys, and he would sell them to the miners for a shilling a week. And very often, of course, the clothes were worn out before they were paid for, but then they would be buying more. It was a very hard way to make a living, but he made a small living that way, as did many of his contemporaries.
When did you leave Cardiff and go to London?
I went to university in Cardiff, So I was there till I was 21. Then I taught for a while. Then I married and I lived in London, which is a very beautiful city.
And you've been there ever since?
Been there ever since. Mm-hmm.
You won the Booker Prize in 1970 for the elected member. What did the Booker Prize mean to you?
It staggered me. I didn't expect to win it. I was fortunately on my next book when I had it, when I won the prize. Otherwise, I think I would have been blocked for a little while. It meant quite... It simply meant I could earn a living as a novelist, whereas before I couldn't, because what the Booker Prize meant was foreign rights, American rights. One can't live as a novelist in England just on one's English rights. It's impossible. You have to sell abroad, and especially in America. And that's the difference the Booker Prize made to me. Quite a radical difference.
What is the Booker Prize exactly? Does it have any equivalent in the United States?
I don't think so. I think you possibly have more prestigious prizes. Booker is prestigious, but it hasn't been going all that long, and I think your Pulitzer, for example, is much more prestigious, though it's probably not worth as much. I don't know what your Pulitzers are worth.
I don't know either, but they're very widespread. It's not just
literary.
Are they
literary. Do they?
The Pulitzers were aimed initially at awards to journalists, but it's been expanded to a variety of other topics, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry.
It still has a very respectable ring throughout the world, doesn't it, though, Pulitzer?
Yes.
It's very established and it's prestigious. And I don't think it's related to the money. The Booker Prize is a lot of money and lots of spin-offs, but I think it has to be in existence for at least 50 years before it really has that meaning.
How do you have your working space set up? You have an apartment in London?
Yes.
How does that? How do you have that set up in terms of how you work?
I have a study and I have quiet. All I need for working is quiet. I live in a very quiet part of London. And I live alone, which makes it quieter. And that's it. I play music a lot, so I have a music section of the apartment and the working section and the sleeping section.
You play what?
Cello.
Do you have a group that you play with?
Yeah, a non-professional chamber quartet. We play about once a week.
In your apartment?
Yes, because I have a very big living room.
Tell me about your work habits. How do you, when you start to write a novel, such as Brothers, how do you do it? How do you organize yourself?
The answer to that is very, it's kind of paradoxical. I sit down. When people say to me, how do you write a novel? I say, you sit down. Or if you're Hemingway, you stand up. The point is you've got to stay sitting, because sitting down is the act of commitment. That's all it is. It's sitting down. It's getting the first sentence out and hoping that the first sentence will generate the next, which usually does, if you sit and wait.
I have a complex novel in Brothers, so you must have had to do a lot of planning. Did you do this mentally? Did you write notes, index cards? How did you organize it?
Brothers is different from any novel I've written, exactly in that respect, because I was, in a way, bound by the history of it. I had guidelines, plot guidelines. I couldn't really rely on inspiration, as it were. So this is really the first book I've ever planned. I tend not to plot my books. Possibly it shows. But I had to plan Brothers because there are an awful lot of characters and it covers 180 years. So I made notes of the major events, historical events in each section, and also notes of what characters were involved in each event. And I went from there.
Are you involved at all with the literary establishment in England?
Oh, yes. It's quite small and it's very incestuous, and most of my friends are writers.
Paul Theroux was in town not too long ago. We chatted for half an hour, and I understand there's been some bitter reaction to his book called The Kingdom by the Sea. Have you read that?
Yes, I have, and I love it. I do understand. Now, I do understand. I mean, being Jewish and being Welsh, in a way, I don't feel, although I love England, I don't feel possibly as responsible for England as those people who hated Paul's book. I think it was a non-Englishman's point of view, but in many ways it was totally exact. It really is what England is like today. And I think there's a kind of resentment amongst Englishmen that a foreigner has to come and pick it out with such insight, which he did. It's a beautiful book, and it's very funny.
Yes, Thoreau told me that the British have rarely allowed themselves to be microscopically picked at.
No.
They have a very blatant characterization of many Americans, which he says is not only unfair, but it's untrue. They rarely look introspectively at themselves. And the image he wanted to relay in his book was an old English couple sitting in their car on a cliff with their back to the mainland, looking far out to the sea. And I thought that was an awfully sad characterization. I was also shocked at how seedy. I've been to London and I've been through England, but I haven't. I didn't go to the boarding houses with their cabbage smells along the coast, but I was shocked at the seediness that Paul Theroux portrayed along the English coast.
But he's right, it is seedy. But an Englishman might look upon that seediness with a certain amount of pride and love, even, whereas Paul Theroux possibly couldn't. It doesn't make him less exact. All it makes him is a different eye. It's not surprising they didn't like it.
Well, I know you're Welsh. I was hoping that you'd say something in an angry way, say, oh, Thoreau wronged this country. But you're not
sorry.
Going to do that. I can't get an argument out of you. Actually, in some respects, reading about the English coastline reminded me of the Jersey Shore. There's some very seedy towns along the New Jersey Shore in the United States.
Yeah.
Have you traveled throughout this country at all? I know you say you've been in New York.
No, I don't know. I know Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and Boston. And Milwaukee a little, because I have
Milwaukee.
Friends there. Yeah. But no, I don't think I know America at all. And every time I come here, I know it less. But I love it. Because it is so non-private. It's terribly good for a writer, this place. I mean, you can just go for a walk and you can pick up a million ideas for novels because people talk to you. And they don't expect any comeback from you. They seem to want to be known wholly and very quickly, without any prompting. And it really is quite something. You can go to a cocktail party here, and within 5 minutes you'll know the marital situation of any woman or man who comes up to you. That would take you a year in England.
Of course, in New York, it's difficult to find someone who speaks English.
What do they speak here?
Well, Hispanic seems to be the dominant language now, and then you hear Chinese, Vietnamese, you're a lot of Russian, a lot of Italian.
Mm-hmm. Does that worry you?
No. When I came to New York, I knew it was a melting pot of cities in this country. And that's why New York is so big, because so many people from all over the world have come here and they live in peace. And in fact, a young writer, I hope you read his work, and I hope he's published in England, his name is Mark Helprin. He's written a magnificent novel called Winter's Tale. It's published by Harcourt Brace and Jovanovich. It's a celebration of the city. He doesn't have this line in the book, but he told me he had to take it out for problems of length. But he said, you may criticize New York, you may find it sometimes violent, sometimes dirty, but it is the place where Western civilization is working things out. And I think he's probably right. City will probably die at some point and be replaced by Sao Paulo or someplace like that. But right now, it seems to be a very exciting city to visit and exciting city to live in.
How would you feel if I were to say to you that you're working out your civilization in Greenham Common in England, which is something I feel very strongly about? We would have a right to say that, I think.
Mm-hmm. That may be the case, and today there was a large demonstration in Greenham Common because they are starting to deploy these missiles in various launch sites around Britain. So there was quite a controversy about that. Well, we've talked for quite a while. I think my last question to you should be to have you put on your or look into your crystal ball a little bit, or perhaps you don't have to do this because you know it, and tell me what's going to be ahead for you from a literary standpoint.
Now, I'm not too sure. I'm sort of half working on two novels at the moment. I'd like to write a smaller novel now, a shorter one, and not a historical one. I'd like to go back, perhaps, to the kind of novel I wrote before that is about mood. It really, in a way, harder to write an introspective novel like that. When you're writing brothers, you've got guidelines of plot and so on. When you're writing the other kind of book, which I write, you really only have the guidelines of mood change, which is not so reliable. But nevertheless, I'm happy in writing about odd people. And I'm halfway through a book about a very odd person indeed, and I think that's what I shall finish next.
Ms. Rubens, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.